This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, Diana Johnstone, is an American journalist based in Paris whose writings focused primarily on European politics and Western foreign policy. During the Vietnam War, she organized the first contact between American citizens and Vietnamese representatives. Since then, she has lived in France, Germany, Italy, from where she worked from 1979 to 1990 as the European editor of the U.S. Weekly In These Times. She was also press officer of the Green Group in the European Parliament from 1990 to 1996. She has written three books: The Politics of Euro Missiles, Europe's Role in America's World in 1985, Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and the Western Delusions in 2003, which challenged the official narrative of the Bosnian War and the destruction of Yugoslavia, and Queen of Chaos, a critical examination of Hillary Clinton, about which we spoke in 2015. More recently, she has been writing for Consortium News, where her article, The Real Russian Interference in U.S. Politics, was published last month. I've interviewed Diana several times, once from her apartment in Paris, so it's nice to have her back. Welcome, Diana Johnstone, to Takes on the World.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation.
Well, it's always my pleasure. Last month you wrote an article for Consortium News providing details and insight into some other examples of Russian interference in American politics that the mainstream media seems to not have been very troubled about. Begin to tell us about that.
Well, I wanted to make the point that there is indeed Russian interference in American politics, but it's on the part of people who are against Putin rather than by Putin. And in fact, the really effective Russian interference is in opposition to the Putin government. And that opposition is extremely welcome. In fact, it's welcome in the Congress, where a motion in favor of oligarchs is passed nearly unanimously by the Congress. So you see, this whole thing about my whole point is about interference. We're in this global system, which, according to the United States, they want a global system where everybody interferes in everybody else. So it's really very contrary to their own philosophy when they suddenly say, oh, Russians mustn't say anything in our country, when in fact, of course, the United States is interfering everywhere, but also the United States welcomes interference when it's the kind of interference that encourages American interference elsewhere.
You're referring, for example, the Iraq War, in which we had Shalabi with a phony Iraqi organization lobbying for the U.S. to intervene. Is that one of the examples?
And we have. Well, that's what, oh yes, that's a very striking example. But I'll give you one right now. Is Mujahideen al-Khalq, this group which was officially a terrorist group, and now is being widely sponsored by the United States because it wants to overthrow the Iranian government. And Giuliani recently made a big speech with at their conference. Hooray, go to it, overthrow the Iranian government. Already we're making them suffer. Let's make them suffer more. That's really the way he spoke. So we're letting this Iranian opposition group, which is violent, interfere our politics because we'll end up paying for them. We are paying for all these groups. So that kind of interference is very welcome because it's an invitation for us to interfere in Iran or in Iraq or in Syria or in Libya. All of these wars have been preceded by political interference by opposition people from those countries who've come over and said, come and overthrow my government because we all want democracy just like you, which, of course, is totally a lie.
Yes, I remember that Mujahideen Khalq, actually, I fought on the side of Saddam in the Iraq-Iran war, and were listed on the U.S. Terrorism role as a terrorist organization until Iran got in our sights, and then they had very powerful lobbyists on their behalf to get them off our terrorism list. So that There's recently we've had attacks in Iran that have attributed to the
Mujahideen. Yes, that's right. Some of the explosions, if they're not Israeli explosions, they're probably Mujahideen al-Khalq. But you know what I want to say with the about the Mujahideen al-Khalq. The United States has an absolute gift, and I must say, the late unlamented Senator McCain was an expert at this because he was in charge of the Republican branch of the NED. NED, what does it stand for?
The National Endowment for Democracy. National Endowment for Democracy.
Endowment for Democracy, which is, in fact, a large fund that is used to go around the world and give support, if not bribes, to opposition groups to cause trouble in their own countries in the name of democracy, to give us an excuse to intervene or have sanctions or something like that. And, I mean, that was his scrape. I mean, he's a perfect example that the United States goes around, and not surprisingly, they find the worst people in every country. Now, they say what I say, worst people, because they tend to be traitors to their own country. They tend to be gangsters or oligarchs who are in tax trouble and want to overthrow the government so they don't have to pay taxes, or just fanatics. And everywhere the United States goes, and it finds these are the people yearning for the democracy that we are going to pay for so that we can weaken their governments. And it's just, I mean, it's horrendous how much we encourage the worst elements everywhere, aside from the other damage we do.
Getting back to Russia, it's interesting. We read in the U.S. papers all the time about Russian oligarchs who have built billions of dollars owning Russia's natural resources, but rarely do you find an explanation of how these oligarchs came to have their riches. And you do make a reference to Michael Khodorkovsky, who is became the darling of Washington. Perhaps you could tell us who he is and how he got his money.
Well, you see, all of this was really done by the Clinton administration, because the Russians, I mean, with the collapse of communism and the overthrow of Gorbachev by Yeltsin, the Moscow was full of these people who thought America is our friend and going to show us how to do capitalism. So the experts went in and showed them how to do capitalism, and this is how they did it. There were individuals who, like Khodorkovsky, who was he? He was an official of the Communist Youth Organization, so he was well-connected. So you have a lot of well-connected individuals, not a lot of them, a handful of well-connected individuals, often connected to Israel, by the way. So they became the financial intermediaries who lent money to the government, which they probably didn't have, but you know how money is created by lending. And on the understanding that that when the government went bankrupt, as was expected, couldn't pay back these loans, the lenders, like Khodorkovsky, would get huge amounts of stock, I mean controlling stock, in basic resources, notably petroleum. And so by this device, these handful of people who came from nothing, well, they came from they were apparatchiks, basically, took over the basis of the Russian economy. And, I mean, when you say oligarchs, of course, the United States is full of oligarchs, too, and notably in the communications industry. And I think in the United States, too, these oligarchs that we have, which are running Facebook and Google and all that, are also hand-in-hand with the government. And go back to Russia. So these oligarchs were favored by the Yeltsin government, which, by the way, was reelected, as Time magazine pointed out, with help from the United States. So this was an operation that amounted to a pillage of the Russian economy, which plunged the country into poverty, led to so many suicides that the population actually dropped quite considerably. The life expectancy dropped. It was an absolute catastrophe. So what Putin has done was to stop the oligarchs who were working too much for foreign interests. I mean, there are still oligarchs in Russia. They were not created by Putin. On the contrary, what he did was to put a brake on Khodorkovsky, for example, because Khodorkovsky was working with Exxon and Chevron to sell Russian oil resources. I don't mean the oil, but I mean the companies to Exxon and Chevron, so that Russia would no longer be owner of its basic resources. And this is what Putin stopped, that's all. And he actually, the other businessmen, if they play the game, if they don't try to absolutely destroy the country, keep doing their business. But this is not a Putin thing. This is a leftover from the earlier period.
Well, it's interesting. The U.S. bragged about the U.S. influence of getting Yeltsin reelected, which set this whole process in motion. And it's interesting, just before Khodorkovsky was arrested, I remember reading in the financial pages that he was about to sell 20% of Yukos oil to Exxon. And that's when Putin stepped in and had him arrested. And then he became the darling of the Democrats, and particularly Joe Biden. And tell us about that.
Well, of course, because, I mean, the whole point is of the Americans is, they, of course, politically, the political establishment was perfectly happy to have this. They thought they were turning Russia into a satellite, and it looked that way for quite a while. So they are inconsolable as to having Russia suddenly sort of want to come back to life as a more or less independent country. The leaders of the United States just find that unbearable, and that's the source of all this anti-Russian hatred that we have now. I mean, they're supposed to be ours, like the whole world. How dare they? And but you asked me the question. I think I got off it. What were you asking me there?
How Khodorkovsky became the darling of the Democrats and Uncle Joe Biden.
Biden. That was it. It was Biden. Well, Biden is a big player in all this. Biden has been sort of a low-key McCain. Of course, McCain is very flamboyant and goes around with. But Biden, he put his son in charge of the banking industry in Ukraine. He was backing the Kosovar rebels. He sponsored a bill in the Senate to say that Khodorkovsky shouldn't have been persecuted by the Russians. So he's a big, big player in this very top of intervention, which is a largely an economic intervention by taking over economies. And he's it's interesting because he comes from Delaware, which, as I understand it, is a tax haven state.
It's not really a tax haven state. It actually is. It's where many of the credit card companies are based because they have very fine tax deals. And here's a man, a senator from a state that majority of people could not find on the map, has, well, tremendous power. He was actually You can, those who watched the Anita Hill or Clarence Thomas game would see how the role Joe Biden played in getting Clarence Thomas on the court when the Democrats were in control of the Senate. Interesting period, which is brought back today, the question of this guy Kavanaugh. But Biden's role, he's even talking about a 2020 run for president. I think that need be shot down as soon as possible. But in any case, you wrote about him passing a bill for Khodorkovsky, but you have something in your article I want to read that was written by Khodorkovsky, A Capitalist Manifesto. This is Khodorkovsky. He says, "Our guiding light is profit, acquired in a strictly legal way. Our Lord is His Majesty money, for it is only He, with capital H, who can lead us to wealth as a norm in life," end quote. And you write, the author of this bold tract with Michael Khodorkovsky, who went on to become the richest man of Russia, and his business partner at the time, Leonid Nevzlin, who has since retired comfortably in Israel. I should mention, they don't like to talk about it in the media, but all these oligarchs, by amazing coincidence, happen to be Jewish, Russian Jews, secular Jews, most of them. But you don't want to mention that name and connection with oligarchs and capitalism, because then people will say you're being anti-Semitic, but their ties to Israel and being
Jewish
is a
fact. Well, you see, I think the ties to Israel are significant because it's a place you can run to when you're in trouble. I mean, that's sort of what the Jewish state is, you see. Since any Jew can get in there just like that, and if you're being accused of huge tax fraud, I mean, Mr. Rich, I think, was one of those, and these daring financial adventures are naturally undertaken by these guys who knows that they can get out of there and go to Israel and be completely safe. So besides that, there's a connection. You know, there's they know each other and they can help each other out, and they have connections in New York and London and so on. So it's not too surprising. It doesn't have much to do with religion. It's a network.
There's another character that you write about who fascinates me. Happens to be the grandson of the former head of the Communist Party of the United States, Earl Browder, named Bill Browder, who became also a darling of Washington, even though he gave up his citizenship to avoid paying U.S. taxes. Tell us about Bill Browder, what he's up to.
Well, he's amazing. He's another one who went over there to Russia to take advantage of this free-for-all grabbing stuff. Not as much as Khodorkovsky, but he had some schemes and made some money. But of course, a lot of these people were, well, they didn't consider hardly that the law counted. You've got to realize that this was sort of the Wild West. So I don't know how conscious they were of breaking laws, because I don't think they were very concerned. But anyway, William Browder did get into difficulties. And so the Russian government was after him for various financial fraud things. So he comes to Washington, and apparently it was this individual named Jonathan Weiner, who is a big Clintonite, at that time was in the State Department, although he's been in various things. And he seems to be the one who explained to Browder how he could get out of this trouble, because the Russians might want to extradite him. And you see, they might have been able to extradite him from the United States precisely because he'd given up his American citizenship. He wasn't an American citizen, in which case he could be extradited. And so the way, when if you don't go to Israel, what you do is you go to the United States and you say, oh, it's all political persecution. Has nothing to do with money. It's political persecution. And Browder had an accountant named Magnitsky, who was arrested probably for funny business with the books, you know, accounting, and unfortunately died in prison. But it's pretty documented that he died of, he was unhealthy and he died of medical neglect, which is very unfortunate. But Browder comes and tells the story to the whole world that actually his accountant was not an accountant. He was a crusading lawyer for human rights and had been murdered brutally by a whole bunch of police thugs in prison. And he's told this story to the Senate, to the Congress, to the media, to everybody, to such an extent that the Congress in 2012 passed legislation called the Magnitsky Act, which began the whole campaign of sanctions against Russia. It was a big step in ruining U.S.-Russian relations, all on the basis of this far-fetched story that Magnitsky told. Now, this has been revealed in an excellent documentary film, which is banned in the United States.
That doesn't surprise me, but it's interesting how the United States members of Congress are so get exercised and so churned up about injustices being committed, real or imagined, alleged in other countries. But what happens here, almost every week you see an article in the New York Times about some prisoner who's been in an American prison for maybe 25, 30, 40 years, who's been exonerated when DNA proves a person was innocent or was set up by aggressive police who were looking for promotions. And there's no concern, American Congress of either party, about these people.
Important point, because the United States has no business at this point to be preaching human rights to people when they've got the largest prison population in the world and with the longest sentences. And also, there's a hideous thing in the American justice system or injustice system, which is the plea bargain. And the plea bargain is something that really gets around justice, because you accuse somebody. I mean, this was done with the alleged assassin of Martin Luther King, who was surely innocent. You get a court-appointed lawyer, because he doesn't have any money. This is for any poor guy. He doesn't have any money, and the court says, look, if you try to fight this and plead innocent, you'll be convicted and you might be executed. But you just say you're sorry, and then you'll be put in jail forever and ever, but you won't be executed. And this works over, and then there's no trial, no jury, and a lot of people, you see, end up in prison without ever having a trial, without ever having to confront proof at all, because of this really vicious plea bargains, because it saves a lot of money for the judicial system, but it's extremely vicious.
My guest is Diana Johnstone, and it is vicious. And they say, at least according to the newspapers, 94% of the cases that come to court, criminal cases, result in plea bargains. And so they have a whole list of charges that are totally ridiculous. And then they say, well, we will cut all these charges out if you plea to this lesser charge, and you won't get life, you might get 10 years. And a poor man who doesn't have a chance and doesn't have a lawyer, can't afford a lawyer, accepts this. And this is 94% of American criminal cases end up with plea bargains.
So it's very, the district attorneys or the prosecution can be very proud. They've convicted all these criminals. You know, the list, it goes longer and longer. Look what we've done. And all of these poor people have no real defense. And 94%, I mean, that's pretty overwhelming.
Even getting off the subject of Russia for a moment, just in the paper the other day, New York Times, I read the obituary of a cop, former Vietnam vet, became a torturer in Chicago prisons and tortured and beat, had other cops, he had a gang beating up prisoners, forcing them to confess, fabricating evidence. He lost his job, didn't do a day of, he actually did a few, 3 years in prison, but retired with his $4,000 a month pension. No anger in Congress about this. It was a big story in Chicago. One of the reasons Rahm Emanuel is not running for re-election is because all this was sanctioned in Chicago under the government of Chicago. It didn't matter who was the mayor, but this case was Rahm Emanuel. Well, getting back.
I just want to say something here. Because the United States, a lot of this is privatized or it's scattered or it's decentralized. So you never say, oh, the president, unless it's Trump because everybody hates him, but you don't use it was Obama. You don't say Obama did this. Anything that goes wrong in Russia, it's Putin. You know, we personalize it. But these things are just little details in the United States. It has nothing, no political significance.
That's quite interesting. Yeah, we have this in today's New York Times. We have another article about a Russian radio station or online radio called USA Really, which is started by a Russian, critical of the United States. And we act so innocent here. But the interesting, they have a timeline, and the very top of the timeline, or not table organization, I should say, not a timeline, and the table organization, of course, is Putin, as if he is ordering this young man to start this radio station or go online and go on to Facebook and so on. But this is, I quoted earlier before I called you, the a comment by Mairead Maguire, the former Nobel Prize winner from Northern Ireland, about the demonization of Russia. But we always need a bogeyman. And I, earlier programs, have pointed out that before the crisis in Ukraine, before the protests in Maidan Square, and only in the Western Ukraine, there was no conflict with Russia. NATO had nothing really to do. It was in Europe, and suddenly we needed a conflict, and we had Victoria Nuland, the Hillary Clinton's former press spokeswoman, who also worked for Dick Cheney, and was the wife of Robert Kagan, the founder of Project for New American Century. She was over there orchestrating this coup. And even when Yanukovych, who was corrupt like every government leader in Ukraine has been, it's a national problem, had agreed to have an election in which he was going to step down, the attacks against him increased, particularly on the part of the neo-Nazi element. And because obviously some country wanted a conflict there, and Putin understandably saw that Crimea was going to be taken away, the port they had in Crimea. What do you take on that? That this whole thing was designed in Ukraine to actually renew a Cold War with Russia. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that's without any doubt. You know, I'm just tired of all this. You see, all of this is documented. I mean, as you were saying, I mean, for instance, our scholars that have documented this, I've quoted them in articles and things. All of this is totally documented. It's perfectly obvious. And what is amazing is you see you have all these American newspapers and they do not tell the story. They tell the myth. They tell the legend. They tell the propaganda version that the United States is telling them. Nobody except little people like us are doing any investigating journalism to tell the truth. Well, somebody is. I mean, Stephen Cohen does, and what happens? He's even a top expert, and he becomes a pariah. So all of this is unquestionably true. I mean, there isn't any doubt about it. This whole thing is invented because for two reasons. The military-industrial complex has to have its cause, has to keep the billions flowing. And also, ideologically, the ruling class, with the help of the neocons, and Brzezinski, who's not a neocon but is a Polish nationalist, is totally sold on the idea that the United States must dominate the world forever or the world will come to an end. Well, it may come to an end because the U.S. insists on dominating. All of this is completely invented, and I've never seen anything like it. I thought there were a lot of lies around Yugoslavia, but it's nothing. They've made up this whole story. It's been swallowed even by Bernie Sanders. It's unbelievable. And in the rest of the world, people don't believe it like that, but they don't. In Europe, nobody dares say anything because this is just a satellite. Western Europe is a satellite. But I'm really tired. I'm tired of being indignant all the time, as if it were my specialty to be indignant when other people should be indignant. Everybody should be indignant. And I'm just sick of that specialization. I just want to quit and let other people be indignant in my place. I'm too old for this.
I join you in that. We're the same age, and I find myself indignant all the time. Maybe it's what keeps the blood flowing, but this is a real problem. We have no anti-war movement. We have the same kind of buildup toward the war in Iran with the sanctions and the threats and the lies, even more so about Iran than about Saddam, and. We're ready to have a war, and the Europeans are trying to actually do something about the sanctions, but they're being threatened yesterday by John Bolton. There'll be terrible consequences for anybody who challenges the U.S. and its sanctions. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, well, the terrible things that happen are economic. You see, the United States has total economic control of Europe. I have an account in the Bank of Paris, BNP. It's the biggest bank in Paris. And I was in the bank the other day to do some business, and I was told by somebody, do you realize that the CIA has somebody in the top of the BNP to make sure they don't do anything that the Americans don't want? And you see, they've been fined billions of dollars if they deal with Iran. The United States has got a stranglehold on the economies of Europe, besides the fact that they're militarily occupying them. Italy is full of nuclear weapons aimed at Russia. Now there are going to be more in Germany, Poland, the Baltic states. These are just places that the U.S. uses to threaten Russia. And the Europeans don't do anything about it because they're scared. And their reason to be scared because the U.S. has a stranglehold on their financial dealings.
We had warnings here about the weather. We should have warnings about the war, the war makers. But
right.
No, seriously, it's quite extraordinary how it's true. The appointment of the next Supreme Court justice is extremely important, particularly Republicans want to get it because it would just cement the control of the corporations, which is have been running American society for decades, but even make it cemented in. And so the Republicans are ready, I believe, to get rid of Trump as long after they get all the things that they want. But there is no concern whatsoever on the part of any of the new Democrats, whatever, of policy in the Middle East.
That's probably, if Trump does it, some of them will find some reason to criticize it. But they would be doing the same thing if they were in power. I mean, the fact is that it just doesn't look to anybody outside of the United States or in the United States as if Trump is in power anymore. I mean, he may look to be in power in domestic issues precisely because he's doing things that the Republican majority wants. But when it comes to foreign policy, he says one thing and Nikki Haley says the opposite. And then they go, and he says, we'll get out of Syria. And the government says, no, we're staying. And he doesn't seem to be in charge at all. The only good thing so far has been about Korea. I don't know if they're going to mess that up. But it just looks like, you see, I said this in my Hillary book. If you're going to change American policy, you've got to take power with a very good team. And Trump never had a team. He's a TV star. He just came in with some ideas, some of them terrible, some of them not so terrible. But he's not in control. He's never been in control. He didn't know who to put in power. He didn't know who are the good people who could run a decent foreign policy, if that's what he wanted.
And Sheldon Adelson came along and put money in his pocket and bought him as a toy for Israel. Diana Johnson, it's been great talking to you again. I wish I was there in Paris and having dinner with you, maybe next time. But thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes of the World. And keep on keeping on, as they say.
Okay, same to you.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.